Hello, everybody, and welcome back to We've Got a Mail podcast for you to enjoy that includes this harp noise.
The title is simply We've Got Mail.
It is. My name is William Bibbiani. I'm a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic. I contribute to Slash Film. Writing a lot about Spider-Man these days.
Yeah, there's a lot of Spider-Mans.
There's a new Spider-Man picture this week.
And there's a Spider-Man's picture.
Many spider people and animals.
Spider person, spider animals, spider objects.
There's a spider car.
That's from the comics. There's a spider character called Peter Parked Car.
Isn't that cute?
It's the cutest goddamn thing. I think that's my favorite one.
We'll get to your letters. You send us emails or actual physical letters, and we read them and we respond to them in kind. But we'll get to those in a second.
Mm. What's up?
Buddy? There is a scene in the new Spider-Man.
Okay, no spoilers.
I love this because they're clearly like raising a middle finger to the people who really like to write down Easter eggs and references. Uh-huh. Because they pan across, like, a crowd of different Spider-Men, and each one gets, like, a little Chiron. It's just describing their name and where they're from. And they pan by so quickly that they just pop on for, like, a fraction of a second. Mm-hmm. It's like, this is either made for people who really want to, like, watch frame by frame once they buy a Blu-ray of it.
Uh-huh.
Or it's just like, look, it doesn't matter. You don't need to know all that information.
We promise you we did the research. Yeah. You don't have to worry about it. We know who they are. Mm. Anyway, maybe we'll talk about Peter Parker and various Miles Morales' and Gwen Stacy's and Spider-Man's this episode. Maybe we won't. because we don't have any say in that matter. In fact, Whitney kind of hijacked the podcast right there. I'm very disappointed in him. This is We've Got Mail. I get to do that every once in a while.
You
get to do it.
Okay, I'll just let you do it every time. It's okay. Yeah. But that's mine. My prerogative.
That's fine. I love you. Everyone gets one.
I'm fine. I'll let you continue to speak over me and interrupt me and do your thing.
I just wanted to introduce the show because the whole point of the show is that our listeners get to tell us what to talk about.
Uh-huh.
And you do that by emailing us. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net.
Mm.
Or you could write us a snail mail. Our P.O. box is P.O. box.
You know, I say it every, like, on every podcast. I say what it is.
641.
Yes.
565?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Now send us a letter to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064. Do it today.
Did you ever see the movie Free Jack?
I did see the movie Free Jack.
Remember, at the end?
With Mick Jagger.
With Mick Jagger, Anthony Hopkins, Rene Russo, and Emilio Estevez. And at the end, Emilio Estevez has to prove that Anthony Hopkins has downloaded himself into Emilio Estevez's brain by telling Mick Jagger Anthony Hopkins' social security number. And it's just him, like, rubbing his temples. Six. And Mick Jagger's like, go on. And it's my favorite bit of acting. And my favorite...
Because Emilio Estevez... Okay, the premise of Free Jack.
Yes.
We're going off on another tangent before we even get to the letters.
That's true.
It's a movie from 1991, 92, around
early
there.
90s, early 90s.
And in the future, the wealthy are able to reach into the past and snatch people up at the moment of their death and take them into the future and then... Since they're legally dead, they can now wipe their brains clean and shunt their consciousness into a younger body that they've stolen from the past.
So they can keep their perpetual life going. It's kind of like that movie Millennium, except
Millennium, they're taking people from the past because they need breeding stock in the future.
The reason why is because the future is fucked. We need people who had healthy bodies from the past.
Yeah.
And we take them from the moment before their death so that we won't be upsetting the timeline.
Exactly.
So Emilio Estevez is going to be free-jacked, and then he wakes up, but he escapes. He gets on the run in the future, and Mick Jagger is responsible for hunting him down. And he's like, we've got a free Jack, as if we're supposed to know what that means. Seriously, it's a made-up word. We've got a Shumbawamba.
Well, it's like Logan's Run. Run, runner. But of course, you know what a runner is. At the end of that movie, Emilio Estevez is apprehended, but he's got the drop on Anthony Hopkins.
Yeah.
And so he only pretends that Anthony Hopkins has been shunted into his brain. Mm-hmm. So Emilio Estevez has to act like Anthony Hopkins, and it's one of the most awkward pieces of acting. Now, I'm positive on Emilio Estevez, actually.
Oh, yeah, I like Emilio Estevez just fine, but he's fine. He's no Anthony Hopkins.
Well, he's a very different kind of actor than Anthony Hopkins. So when he tries to imitate him, it's just embarrassing.
I actually really like Mick Jagger in that movie. One of my more embarrassing moments ever was I was interviewing a guy, and he was a screenwriter, and he was about to go work on a show he was executive producing with Mick Jagger. And right after my interview, he says, yeah, I'm literally about to walk into a room with Mick Jagger. And wow. I was like, can you send him a message? And the guy's like, sure. Tell him he was awesome in Free Jack. And he's like, okay. And I hang up and I'm like, I could have made him tell Mick Jagger anything. And I said, tell him he was awesome in Free Jack. Mick Jagger was like, all right, let's talk about this new show we're doing on HBO. What is it? Oh, you were awesome in Free Jack. Yeah. Yeah, I was.
It'd be really awkward to bring up like Altamont or something. Here, remember Altamont? Don't talk about Altamont. It's a miserable experience.
Anyway, we promise we'll make up this like 6 minutes we wasted at the end of the show. We'll go a little long. Whitney,
yes.
let's read some emails for the love of God.
Oh, fine, if we must.
Alright.
Here's a letter from Andrew. Hello, Andrew.
Hey, Andrew.
Hi, Bibbs and Whitney. I've been loving your new show, Thank Godzilla It's Friday.
Yeah. Hey, thank you so much.
And the discussions about how the U.S. film industry completely butchers translations of international media. I keep bumping up against something that's been bothering me, though.
Okay.
In describing these mistranslations, you keep using the word boldlerize. I do not think that means what you think it means.
Did we boldlerize?
What you seem to interpret it as anglicization, making a foreign word more harmonious to the English speaker's ear. What boulderization is excising offensive material from a work in order to sanitize it by removing potentially offensive content to fit a particular moralistic worldview.
Oh, we are totally way off then. My apologies.
Hang on a second. A mild form was recently the editing of Splash by Disney to cover up Daryl Hannah's butt so as not to offend the viewer's delicate sensibilities. Boulderize also means to sort of shorten or abridge in a way that changes the meaning a little bit.
Either way, we were using it wrong.
No, I was using it correctly.
You were using it, abridging, so I'm looking it up right now in dictionary, Merriam-Webster.
All right.
To expurgate something such as a book by omitting or modifying parts considered vulgar, which is clearly not what we were doing.
Yeah.
And the second definition is to modify by abridging, simplifying, or distorting in style or content. So technically, yes, but that's like the fifth definition.
It's the second definition, thank you. Well, the second one you just read.
It's the third part of the second.
I'm using it correctly, is my point. I want to defend myself.
Okay, all right. I want to throw you under the bus.
I see you're trying to do that. But I am Mr. Furious. I lifted a bus once.
you pushed it, and it was in neutral.
It was already moving. I wanted to defend myself.
All right.
I feel like I was using the word correctly.
Let's finish the email.
But we're both correct, because those are both definitions of what boulderized means.
There is, however, a more common usage, and that can be potentially confusing.
I suppose so.
Yeah.
To continue the letter, though, I do love what you do, and your insightful commentary on movies always makes me think. Good, I'm glad. I particularly enjoyed the recent Iron List on fairy tale movies, and how passionate you both are when it comes to films that you love. The Princess Bride is among my favorite films, so I was very happy to see it make the list.
Yay.
Hard disagree on Labyrinth, though, Whitney.
I'm
one of the assholes who's only kind of warm. I like Labyrinth, but I don't love Labyrinth.
You need to lead with that, because sometimes you sound like an asshole to Labyrinth.
I don't...
you
just, fine.
You come across...
Labyrinth
as...
can take it. Labyrinth can take me being an asshole to it. Everybody else is very kind to that film. There is much more of a story there than you give it credit for. What the film is about is Sarah's journey growing up, becoming more responsible. She wasn't in love with the Goblin King. The story she's play-acting at the beginning is that the Goblin King is in love with her, not the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
She's simply obsessed with the fantasy world. She doesn't believe in the goblins at the beginning of the film when she makes her wish. The theme is her putting away the trappings of her childish imagination, and it persists throughout the movie, but the ending suggests that it will always be part of her world. We're often told that the things we loved as children we are not allowed to take with us into maturity. Labyrinth says we can grow and still maintain that spark of childlike wonder. Always look forward to the next episode of any of your shows. I do miss Cancel Too Soon, but I understand that the time commitment that show entails. Thank you for all the time you put into entertaining us, Andrew.
Yeah. Cancel Too Soon is never far from our thoughts, but it is sometimes hard to put into our schedules.
Yeah.
I'm totally with you on Labyrinth. I don't think it's the greatest fantasy film ever produced or anything like that, but I love it to pieces. I think it's got both personality to spare. It's wonderfully designed. David Bowie is... That was my first experience with David Bowie, I think. I don't think I probably heard his music beforehand, but I didn't like have a face to put to it. So basically, I saw him in Labyrinth, and I'm like, that's it. That's the epitome of human civilization. That's everything we've been working towards is David Bowie. And thank you for showing me that at an early age. I've peaked a little young, but that's fine. I love Labyrinth to pieces. But yeah, Boulder Rising. Yeah, it's... there are multiple definitions. Some may be more common than others.
I suppose maybe the reason I use that second definition more frequently is because that's how I encountered it.
Yeah, exactly.
It's one of those words you read out of books and start using yourself, and you might mispronounce it the first time you say it out loud.
You and I ran into some trouble a few years ago when we reviewed Caddyshack 2, and we got in trouble for liking it too much.
From the director himself, Alan Arkush wrote in and said that we were wrong about the movie he made because we liked it, and he hated that movie that he made.
Yeah, like, everyone hates Caddyshack 2. The people who made Caddyshack 2 hate Caddyshack 2, and we're the critics saying, hang on a second, if you actually watch them and you set aside the nostalgia, Caddyshack 2 is not only quite funny, it's arguably a better film than the original.
Like it's about stuff and has stronger characters. Yeah. It's not just people hanging out being jerks.
Yeah, it feels like it was actually like crafted by people who wanted to tell a story and make a movie rather than found in an editing room after a bunch of like comedians did some improv stuff.
Yeah.
Like that can work. I just argue that Caddyshack 2 works great. Anyway, that's not my point. My point was the bigger objection that Alan Arkush had, and I understand. Was we had referred to Alan Arkush, who has had a really wild, varied career. He's on a lot of television, a lot of different types of movies.
Award nominated, talented guy.
We referred to him as a journeyman filmmaker. We were referring to the definition of journeyman, that is, you are a talented craftsperson and you are good at everything that you do.
And varied, yeah.
Yeah, you will take any assignment and you will do it well.
Which is... one of the definitions of journeyman,
mm-hmm.
but not the one Alan Arkush heard.
No, Alan Arkush
thought we were being
a little bit more derisive.
Kind of flip about it.
And you know what? That is also an accepted meaning definition of the word journeyman. I guess we didn't do a good enough job providing context there.
Yeah.
We came across like jerks. We didn't intend to. We apologized. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you ever heard the apology, but by God, we did. it's... language is tricky. Language is constantly evolving. Yeah. We need words that have actual definitions. Otherwise, we'll never be on the same page with anything.
Yeah.
But things do evolve, and sometimes we get hung up on one definition when there are multiple accepted definitions.
Have you ever used a word repeatedly throughout your life only to have it be corrected?
Oh, I'm sure I have.
You misused a word just constantly?
I am absolutely 100% sure I have.
The one that got me kind of recently, like within the last couple of years, I like to use the word enervated.
And
enervated meant the opposite of what I thought it did. Mm-hmm. I always assumed enervated meant like energized, full of energy. It actually means drained of energy. It means the opposite.
Yeah, it's one of those flammable, inflammable things. Like,
wait a minute. The term disgruntled was really funny because gruntled is a word, and gruntled means pleased.
It doesn't sound like pleased.
Gruntled doesn't sound like you're pleased or relaxed. Like
the ogre gruntled through the countryside, munching on many cows.
Yeah, it sounds like something from Lewis Carroll.
Yeah, it doesn't sound fun, but no, that's what it means. The one I remember very distinctly, I'd gotten two very similar words mixed up, but they are two... words you don't want to mix up, because when you use them wrong, you use them very wrong, impudent and impotent.
Oh, oops.
Yeah, I remember whipping that one out in high school, and everyone's like, what? And I was like, you're being impotent, Dad, I don't know, like...
Impudent.
Impudent. Hmm. What did I say? Oh, shit. Sorry.
Well, one that got me in trouble, I read the word whereas a lot in books.
Oh, yeah.
but I mispronounced it in my mind.
You call it like Warius?
I said Warius. Yeah, so whenever I said it out loud, I would say Warius, thinking I was pronouncing it correctly.
I'm of the opinion that silent letters are cruel jokes on people who read a lot.
I'm like typesetters are just playing pranks on people.
Just throw a G in there just to fuck with them. Yeah, but that's true. There's a lot of names that I've never heard read aloud or spoken aloud by people who know the person in question, so I'm kind of taking my best guess on those.
Yeah, yeah.
I try to research it if I know I'm going to be saying it ahead of time, but I don't always. Stuff like that. That's always embarrassing when you get corrected on that.
Yeah. Well, as somebody with an EI in his name.
Oh, yeah.
For some reason, people very think it's rarely a diphthong. It's like really weird.
It's very rarely pronounced with an I.
Except in Einstein, for goodness sake.
Someone thinks a little highly of themselves, don't you think?
Sure, Einstein. Look, I've already taken a piss on Labyrinth. I may as well just be a supervillain at this point.
What's our next email?
Here's a letter from Miguel. Hello, Miguel.
Hi, Miguel.
Good evening, senors Bibs and Wibs, it says. Let me start by saying I admire your knowledge and experience, including our appreciation for such a wide variety of films. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Guys are always...
Everyone's really nice.
One of these qualities is your strong desire to keep finding new films and giving them a chance, even the films generally regarded as atrocities of cinema. Mm. So you might be familiar with the practice of writing down the titles of films that you can, at some point, watch them, a.k.a. a watch list. Nice. Well, I like to use Letterboxd for this.
A lot of people do. It's a great service.
I do not have a Letterboxd.
I keep meaning to use it more than I do. I just forget to.
Okay.
But I do have it, and I try to update it once in a while, but I definitely don't like catalog everything I watch on there.
I stopped rating films on Letterboxd and simply log them, occasionally writing a small review, but I also like to save film titles I'd like to eventually get to.
Right.
This is a default watch list on the website, but my watch list keeps getting longer and longer over time, so that at some point it didn't feel helpful at all. So I decided to organize it by creating several lists of films.
Oh.
I organized it into broad categories of my own. For example, some are by country, others by decade. I even have a list called Critically Exclaimed, a title I misspelled, where I list your recommendations of films that sparked my interest for one reason or another. Oh, well, thank you. Currently, this list has 120 films.
Oh my God.
And it's a wild and varied list of titles. Once I see a film, I remove it from the list, so it's actually been a longer list.
Wow.
In your opinion, is there a best way to organize a watch list? I still feel like it's disorganized and still don't necessarily find them helpful once they get too large. Secondly, what's the best way to finally watch those movies? They keep getting longer, and I try to imitate what you guys do by creating my own small movie marathons, but I found myself at times lacking the will to get through them. Yeah. What are some tips you guys can do to share on making the process fun and educational? Thank you for taking my email. I'd love to give you both a hug someday, a fan of your work. Miguel,
thank you so much. That's very kind of you.
Hugs. Thank you.
Yeah, we all have our watch lists. Sometimes they're more official. Like, we actually, I've had long notebooks full before Letterboxd existed, full of movies that I need to get through, and I would go through local Blockbusters and just find them and rent them.
Yeah. In 1995, way back in the day, Blockbuster Video and Leonard Maltin put out these gigantic, thick source books of nothing but film titles. Tiny print. You almost needed a magnifying glass to see it. And it was
basically a phone book.
And it was this big phone book, and there were like couple thousand titles in there.
Mm-hmm.
That was a good way to just sort of, if you hadn't heard of something, or discover a title.
It was before we had IMDb, they were listed by film title. You could also look it up. There'd be a glossary of like, look up a director, you'd see all the films they had. That film is on this page. Actors as well, genre.
That was a sort of a good way to browse, but that's not a good watch list. What I found was a good watch list, though, were the other source books.
Mm.
And we've talked a lot about Michael Weldon's Psychotronic Video Guide.
I miss it so.
Michael Weldon put out this really great big book called The Psychotronic Guide to Video and Guide to Video and Film, I think it's called.
Oh, I got a copy right here.
You have it somewhere on your shelf nearby.
I think it's in the other room right now.
Okay, yeah. If you see it, grab it, because it'll be a fun thing to thumb through. And that was Psychotronic was a very specific type of genre film, usually a little bit on the fringe. There were some things that you had also heard of.
Yeah.
But written about in sort of terms of its delicious mayhem. This was a weird film by a weird guy, and it's got like people getting their heads ripped off. Well, that's a fun movie.
A lot of those like Leonard Maltin-y kind of film guides, and I love Leonard Maltin to pieces, but they're very opinionated. There are reviews as well.
Yeah, there's like a star rating on each one.
And I find that a lot of mainstream critics, be they Roger Ebert, Leonard Maltin, or whoever you're thinking of, can be a little dismissive of genre and culty stuff sometimes.
Well, it depends on the critic.
Especially when we were growing up, I found that was rather common. And the Psychotronic Film Guide was very positive on the idea of cult films. They didn't like everything, but they were excited about them, and that enthusiasm like could peeled off the page in like chunks.
Yeah.
And you could like devour
it. Those kinds of guides were a lot more helpful for me. Because if I want to watch a movie, you start thumbing through that. It's like, oh, just... thumb through point, and you get an idea. Of course, now we're in the online world, and those kinds of guides don't really exist anymore.
Well, you can get an old one, but they'll be out of date now. Because they were out of date second they were published.
I'll say, though, they're out of date, but those movies still are out there. That's true. Still fun to watch.
There's just more stuff that should be in there, but
you're not going to get the newer movies, but if you want to just delve into the old stuff, those are great.
That's true. That's a good point.
When it comes to sort of curating your... then later on, after sort of I had gone through those books, I started looking up the top 100 lists that various outlets were publishing. Village Voice had one. Roger Ebert had one.
AFI
had one.
It's weird to me.
I printed those out on little cards and put them in my wallets, and I just crossed them off as I went along.
A lot of them had little checklist marks on them. The AFI top 100, the American Film Institute top 100, they... asked a whole bunch of filmmakers, famous people, filmmakers you'd know, to present their picks for the best American,
specifically American,
motion pictures ever made. And they released a list in 1998, and then they released another one 10 years later, and they released a few in the interim that was more focused, like the biggest movie stars of all time, or the best movie quotes of all time. They have not updated that list, and I think this is the year they need to do that, because I know people, because it's been 25 years.
Yeah.
I know people who still say that they are working their way through the AFI Top 100 list. And for
from 2008.
From 2008, or the 1990s. And listen, for the most part, I don't agree with everything on those lists. For the most part, that's a perfectly okay place to start your filmic journey. You're going to be focusing almost exclusively on American films, but you should probably see most of the films on there. I think that list is overdue for a reappraisal and for some re and decanonizations. For me, the thing that helped me get through a lot of my watch lists, I had some books as well that I would like, okay, I'm going to see everything on this list or whatever, but what really helped me was to gamify it, to turn it into a little game.
Okay.
So I have this giant list of movies. Can I find a way to put them into more manageable sizes? And then take all of these films, let's say I'll take every single, every single film by this director. Let's say I hadn't seen that many Hitchcock movies yet. I'm going to become an expert in Alfred Hitchcock. I'm going to watch these 20 Alfred Hitchcock movies, and that's my goal. And what's cool about that is that when you're done getting through that list, you have probably seen more of those movies than most people that you know. And at the end, you haven't just seen a few cool movies, you've become a little mini expert on something. And then you can become a little expert on something else. That's how we, actually, is how we do a lot of our podcasts. That's Thank Godzilla It's Friday, is part of that. We're going to go through all the Godzilla movies. You've already done that for another project that you've done. That's how you saw them initially.
Yeah.
I want to do the same thing, and we're expanding that list a little bit. So when we're done with that podcast, I will have seen every Godzilla and Godzilla-related movie, and I'll be able to say, I know of which I speak when I speak of Godzilla. And that little reward at the end, that little, just a little, one little token of pride, you know, maybe I'm not the greatest expert on it, but I can say that I've seen them all, and my opinion might, about the series, might mean more than if I hadn't. That makes it worth it for me. That's a goal to reach. So you could do that. You could do every movie in a series, every movie by a filmmaker, every movie on your list from a certain decade, every movie on your list from a certain genre or subgenre. Oh, I'll go through every movie on my list that's a romantic comedy. I'll be the romantic comedy guy for the next few months. That helps me. That helps me get through it. But there's a lot of different ways. And if that isn't working for you, Yeah, I don't know. There's the Whitney had some good suggestions as well, but like, yeah, I find just making it smaller, manageable chunks at the very least, I think is the best way to do it. However, you do that,
smaller, manageable chunks. Or if you're the kind of person who's just sort of constantly accruing titles you'd like to see, doing it by year typically helpful.
It can be useful to paint a picture of what everything that was going on around that time artistically.
Schedule it. Have a night a week where you're going to watch two movies on your list.
That's a good idea. Invite people over if
once,
you can.
Once you have shorter lists, you'll be able to choose those films a lot more easily. But you know that's going to be movie night.
Yeah.
And so you'll be thinking about it ahead of time. I'm going to watch this one come movie night. And that'll help you get at least a couple out of the way.
And I like, and rituals are nice. I like rituals. You know, they help mark the time, and that sounds like, you know, like you're just kind of like scratching into the wall of your prison cell. But I think if you don't have any sort of traditions, you look back over a large spans of time, and sometimes you're like, where did the time go? And now you can say, well, I can tell you where the time went. I watched all these movies. You know, that was cool. I had this night that I did it with friends, or it was a date with myself, a concept that I'm struggling to get used to, but it's a good idea to take time for yourself, to pamper yourself a little bit, to remember. What did Dale Cooper say in Twin Peaks? Every day, get yourself a present. You know, it's like a date with yourself. This is my night. I'm going to put on two movies. I'm going to order a pizza. I'm going to drink a glass of red wine or whatever the hell makes you happy. And I'm going to watch those movies, and that's my Thursday. Nice. And that can be a really lovely thing. Or you can invite other people. You do whatever you want. Anyway, I hope that helps. There's a lot of different ways to do it, and I definitely don't want to be like dogmatic about it. Here's what you have to do.
Yeah.
Definitely don't want to do that.
I mean, the point is to, well, also, the point is to enjoy the movies.
That's true.
Of course, if you're the kind of person who gets a little bit of an academic thrill, if it's sort of like a study project, then
you don't have to enjoy
them. Well, then the approach is going to be a little bit different. Something that helped me in college was I watched in the library. I didn't watch in my dorm.
Yeah.
They had these little, this was the mid-90s, so they had those TV VCR devices set up, and you those just
viewing stations.
And these like little cubbies, and you just sort of sit and you watch, and the TV's like an inch from your face. Because you do that like with a laptop now, I suppose.
Yeah, well, they still have that. When we were doing our Oscars podcast on Patreon, another one of those, where we're reviewing every single movie ever nominated for Best Picture. There were two movies that are currently only available. Like, they're not available on home video. They're not available on streaming. They're not even bootlegged. They're only available at the UCLA archive. Those films are East Lynn and The White Parade. We had to go to the UCLA library. Fortunately, we lived pretty close to it. You know, it wasn't like a huge jaunt for us. But yeah, that's the way that they're still set up. It's not, you know, a clunky old VHS TV, but it's still a little TV in like a cubicle. And you just sort of pick your place. Oh, I'm in spot 13. Send me the movie. And then the MST3K character is like, movie in the hole. And they send the liquid movie. Do your thing. Anyway, I hope that helps.
Here's a letter from Alex.
Hi, Alex.
Hello, Alex. Hello. Starts with hello.
Hello.
I'm glad to finally be adding my questions to the fun discussions you both have on We've Got Mail.
Yay.
Last spring, I gave birth.
Oh, good for you.
Mazel tov. And had a hard time finding motivation to leave the house with the baby, especially during the newborn stage. It's a bit tough.
Sure.
However, listening to your podcast, longer episodes provided the right motivation to get me out of the house. Instead of telling myself to walk for so many minutes or miles, I would literally tell myself, walk for one or two episodes. So thank you for the extra push, and know that I still use that mindset to get the extra motivation boost today.
Well, we do some very long episodes, so you're doing some hikes.
My son is 8, but I remember the baby time, and
you're so tired.
When you are home alone with a baby, it's just a matter of filling the time. Luckily, we had a very nice stroller, so I was able to put the baby in the stroller, and I got to know the neighborhood really well.
Yeah,
we had a camping store nearby our house. It's closed now.
Yeah, I remember that.
But it's called A16, Adventure 16.
I put a gift for you on hold on that store. I paid for it in advance, and then they closed down without telling me. I never got that back, and I never got your gift.
I'm so sorry. Well, you know what? I hope it went to some employee at the very least.
I can only be so mad at it. It wasn't a fortune. Okay. It wasn't cheap, but it wasn't a fortune. Right. So it's fine. I'll let it go. I just think it's funny.
But you know, where do you go when you have a baby? I don't know where to go with this baby. It's a little tiny baby.
Yeah.
Too young for like a play place, and you know, I could drive to a park eventually, but mostly I just wanted to get out of the house.
Yeah.
So I just walk around places in the neighborhood. I'd just take him into grocery stores. I don't know. I'm not even buying anything. I'm just going to go get groceries.
Yeah.
And yeah, the people at the camping store got to know me really well.
It's like, it's a big camping store. It's too. It's really huge.
Look around, and occasionally get things like incense, little things. But you know, I understand that. This need to sort of go out and move around and get out of the world.
That's something we're losing. I obviously it's not equally true everywhere, but here in LA, you know, there just aren't as many like stores to go to hang out. I mean, obviously you want to buy things, but like, you know, like you just want to browse.
Just as Missing Person says, only a nobody walks in LA.
Yeah, but like even so, I would be able to drive somewhere in LA and then hang out at, you know, this cool bookstore, this cool record store. And there are a few, but they're few and far between, and there are all of these giant storefronts, and all they are is grocery stores, takeout restaurants
and dispensaries
but there's nowhere to like hang out and socialize or whatever like that. So like the other day, like I had like an afternoon to myself.
The glory days of the 90s coffee shop are long behind us,
but I think
there's still nice coffee shops.
That's true, but like they're fewer and further between. And the other day I had like a whole afternoon to myself, like all of a sudden, like for the first time in a long time, I'm like, there's no one here. I want to leave the apartment. I'm a little stir crazy. I haven't like had an opportunity to go anywhere. I should go somewhere.
Yeah, just walk.
I spent 45 minutes in a chair just trying to figure out the fuck am I going to do? Well, what do I want to do? Where do I want to go? And I wanted to go. I didn't just want to walk. I wanted to go somewhere.
Okay.
I wanted to have a destination and do something.
You start walking and you figure out on the way. That's the secret.
You don't have that much in walking around.
Pardon?
We don't have that much in walking distance.
No, but you know, you'll figure it out. Even if you just end up at like local liquor store.
I eventually found a comic book store like in Culver City that I hadn't gone to in forever. And I went and it was great. And I frequented them and they were a local business and I, you know, bought some things and it was nice. But there just isn't as much to do to walk around in. So I'm glad that we were able to make the journey more regimented.
Yeah.
You know, like you're able to help in some way. It's nice. Thank you.
Anyway, on to the questions, Alex. Number one, and there's five questions here. So, number one, do biopics have an obligation to be a truthful adaptation of a person? I had a discussion recently about The Greatest Showman, about whether or not it's a biopic or not. Technically, it's about a real person, P.T. Barnum, and starting a show, but everything else was fabricated. Typically, this wouldn't bother me, but in real life, he was notorious for so many horrible things, not limited to letting a whale boil alive on stage, and his identity isn't considered common knowledge for people who know the difference between Hugh Jackman's charismatic Barnum and the real thing. I fear it just romanticizes him for new generations. It's too bad because I love the movie and I wish they changed his name and it would have little or no consequence for the movie. For something like The Greatest Showman, I'm okay with all of the changes because I know P.T. Barnum would have loved it.
I think that would save the movie for me is if it just had like an opening, like a little opening crawl. What you are about to see is not true, but it's what you paid to see.
Yeah.
That would have, it puts P.T. Barnum's stamp on it. It makes it feel like appropriate.
Or just enjoy the show, sucker.
Well, like, you remember when they did Man on the Moon, which is the biopic of comedian Andy Kaufman, starred Jim Carrey? Andy Kaufman was a very conceptual comedian, and he would like to play with his audience's sense of reality. When the writers of the film, and they had written some of the best biopics of the era, Ed Wood, The People vs.
Scott Alexander, and Larry Karaszewski.
Yeah, really, two of the screenwriters that made me want to study film. I was really admired everything that they did. Andy Kaufman's life, the way it actually happened, wasn't structured like a movie. And they couldn't find, within that narrative of his life, a movie chunk. Like, that was how they did The People vs. Larry Flint. They didn't tell the entire story of Larry Flint. They told the story of the Supreme Court case.
Yeah.
Everything relevant leading up to it, and then it ends with the Supreme Court case that he was involved in. That's the narrative. Ed Wood, it focused on his relationship with Bela Lugosi. Boom. That was the narrative. We don't show his whole life. We don't need to see his whole life. We tell the story within it.
Especially End, which was really miserable.
Very depressing. And even the Bela Lugosi stuff is really sugar-coated. When it came to Andy Kaufman, he just didn't have that. And so they realized the only thing we can do in order to tell his story in a biopic is to move things around for dramatic purposes. And then they realized Andy Kaufman would have been fine with that.
Yeah.
And what they did to take the curse off of it was the movie opens with Jim Carrey in character as Andy Kaufman. And I'm not going to do the voice because I can't. He's too good. Mm. But he just comes in and says, "Hi, I'm Andy Kaufman, and this is my movie. It has come to my attention that they changed a bunch of things for dramatic purposes. So I cut out all the baloney. Anything that isn't true isn't in the movie. The movie is much shorter. It is now over."
This is the end of the movie, and they rolled credits.
Show the credits. Mm. And that was the gag.
Yeah.
I think a movie... It's tricky because on one hand, if a movie is...
Well, it depends on the goal of the movie.
Yeah, that's a good point. It does vary. I think there are good examples in both.
There are a lot of Hollywood biographies are meant to be entertainments. And as such, they have to, by necessity, reduce a human life to essentially screenplay beats.
Yeah.
Here's the moment when they're at their low point. Here's a moment of their rise of success. That's why a lot of the music biopics... tend to feel kind of the same, even if the musicians are very different people.
I don't think you've ever actually seen it, but if you've ever seen, specifically, but if anyone's listening has ever seen Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox story.
I haven't seen Walk Hard.
It is a merciless deconstruction of every Hollywood biopic trope.
Yeah.
It is, it kind of just ruins all of them, like even the good ones. Like Ray is a very good movie.
I like
it's
Ray.
It's excellently crafted. The performances are wonderful. It's pretty respectful while also not ignoring things. And then once you see Walk Hard, you realize just how much they just shoehorned a person's life into a formula.
Yeah.
And on one hand, that's what we come to see. We probably go to see a biopic of most people because we like them or are interested in them.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes we go to see a biopic of someone who was a piece of shit, and that's why we're here.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we're here to see a biopic of, like, a Vice, for example, was a biopic of Dick Cheney.
Dick Cheney,
who a lot of people don't like. And the people who do like him, that movie was not made for them at all.
You know, his heart exploded the other day, and somehow he's still alive.
That's incredible.
You remember when he shot a guy in the face?
Yeah, and that guy apologized. The guy he shot in the face apologized to him.
For getting in the way of his gun.
Absolutely incredible. But they don't all have to be love letters. They don't all have to be hagiographies. A lot of them are made with the participation of the families and their estates. And as a result, a lot of them kind of emphasize the good parts.
Yeah, if you've seen Straight Outta Compton.
Yeah.
Dr. Dre and Ice Cube were
very
producers.
Involved.
They were deeply involved. So can't really criticize Dre. There's a scene near the end of Straight Outta Compton about, Dre, you're going through all these hard times right now. What with those assault charges and all? Wait, what? Go
what
back?
Was that?
What was that about the assault
Did
charges?
Did you tell me about the assault charges?
We didn't see that scene.
I'm amazed you brought it up.
Yeah.
You know? It's like when you're watching that movie Air, which is about the history of the Air Jordan and how that shoe came about. And Jason Bateman just says, yeah, I should feel bad about the sweatshops that we have, but mostly I'm concerned about keeping the love of my daughter. Wait, what was that?
Go back one.
So we're not going to talk about that, but we will mention it briefly as an aside in a scene that's supposed to make you endearing. Okay. And it's tricky. Like, and then you get a movie like Blonde, which is they try to say it's not a biopic of Marilyn Monroe, but it's also about Marilyn Monroe's entire life.
It's like that movie aspired to be like a mood piece about Marilyn Monroe. It's like
a mean spirited one too.
I saw a Blonde and Elvis as having similar goals, and that they were trying to sort of
capture a vibe.
Well, like, yeah, tell a biopic of the popular image of a certain kind of celebrity.
Except one of those biopics hates the person.
Blonde seems to,
Hate might be the wrong word.
I don't think it hates Marilyn Monroe, but it does see Marilyn Monroe as just a poor victim who had no agency in her life.
Right.
And that's not entirely accurate about her.
It's not accurate, but it's also not fair. And this is what I think is a big part of it. If you're going to be untruthful in a biopic, and you can't be entirely truthful because you weren't there for every moment of their life, at the very least you're making up dialogue. Well, there's always stuff that you're making up. If you're going to be particularly untruthful, you'd better have a good reason to do it.
Yeah.
Now, that reason might be because it's entertaining and we're going in a completely bizarre magical realism vibe and we're not actually going to be that accurate and that's apparently clear from the beginning. Fine.
Mm.
We're focusing on one particular perspective in order to make a larger point about that person or art or the era. And as a result, it's going to be a little skewed, but it's abundantly clear based on the narrative that we're telling that we have that perspective. If you're not clear about that, and in the end, here's something like Blonde, where it's like, yeah, it clearly has a tone, but it was also just Marilyn Monroe's life. And I found that one to be on the irresponsible side, because it shows her life as completely without joy or even agency. Mm. And that infuriated me. I'm like, why are you making a movie about this person if I don't even get the sense that you really love them?
Well, that's also, like, I would think if somebody, like, who's like a good miserableist, someone like Lars von Trier,
sure,
had made something like Blonde, oof, which was a... And sort of his thesis tends to be humans are built to suffer. Yeah. You know, something really kind of bleak.
But he's angry about that, yeah, though. That's the difference. I don't think... Mm. If Blonde had ended with, like, Marilyn Monroe, like, punching JFK, and, like, all this, like... It would have taken, like, a hard right, I think, at some point, if Lars von Trier had done it.
Or if it had gone into something fantastical, like, she ends up in hell.
Yeah.
And, we, like, God, see her talking.
But maybe it's the cool hell. You know, like the hell, like where all the cool people end up.
Like she goes to hell and she's like weeping in agony. It's like, no, but then she's ruling in hell. Like something completely, that's totally so inappropriate, weird. But you know, at least that would have had a thesis.
Yeah. Alex Cox is Blonde. I think it's a bad idea. But anyway.
Would love to have seen Alex Cox do so. Well, old Alex Cox.
Yeah, maybe not contemporary. But anyway, it's a complicated scenario. There are biopics I like that are not very faithful. Yeah. There are biopics I like that are very faithful. There are biopics that are very faithful that I think are junk, and vice versa. It is, I think, largely based on what is the particular purpose of the particular film you're watching, and whether what they're doing is reasonable, entertaining, responsible.
If it's like a Hollywood biopic, its goal is to be entertaining. It's going to fudge the truth, and I think I think most audiences kind of sense that.
You don't see Rocket Man expecting to go home depressed.
It's also good to like do a little research, make sure understand what has been fabricated.
We should always encourage people never to get their whole history from movies.
There's also a certain kind of movie that is trying to be informative and trying to tell people about maybe an obscure character in history.
That might be the only way you ever even knew they existed. Yeah, how could your perspective on that person not be skewed by the motion picture you just watched?
So sometimes those films, when they're trying to be informative, then it's actually responsible to be more accurate to that person.
Yeah, it's tricky. Mm. You don't want to be entirely beholden to history, but you also don't want to... You do have some responsibility to make sure that you're not warping the minds of your audience. So it's tricky.
Ready for a career in behavioral health? Earn your online degree at Herzing University. Choose from health and human services, psychology, or social work programs. Gain the skills to work, coordinate, and manage nonprofits. Secure a bachelor's in psychology to study mental health or advance your social work career through our online Masters of Social Work. Let us help you become a social change agent. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Text HEALTH to 85109. That's HEALTH to 85109. Or visit herzing.edu.
Question number two.
Okay.
If you were both studio heads and had $100 million to spend on whatever you wanted, while also hopefully making money for the studio as well, what projects would you push or invest in? What writers, directors would you want to on board to help see the projects through? Example, James Wan for Saw Insidious. If I had $100 million, I'd give it to charity.
Brewster's Million situation where you had to keep the studio alive.
Here's the fun idea. Roger Ebert put this idea in my head, and I've been thinking about it ever since. Aardman Animation, Castle Blandings.
Yeah, that's a good
idea. From P.G. Woodhouse. P.G. Woodhouse in Aardman Animation style.
It was famously adapted as Jeeves and Wooster.
No, Jeeves and Wooster is different.
Oh, that's different? I thought they were connected.
Castle Blandings is a different series.
Oh, my bad. Okay.
Do Jeeves and Wooster as well. Why not?
Oh, yeah.
Do a Jeeves and Wooster Aardman show, Aardman movie. Do a Castle Blandings movie in Aardman style.
Mm-hmm.
There's some books I feel like could only be adapted in animation that I'd love to see. Did you ever read Catherine Dunn's Geek Love?
No, I know of it, though.
Yeah. Can't film that one. Not in live action, but I think that would look really cool in animation. Mm-hmm. Get Phil Tippett in there.
Yeah, that's cool. I would probably go the Blumhouse route.
Okay.
Rather than, you know, like, blow it all on a couple of big projects, I would take that $100 million and do a variety of smaller projects with hopefully some breakout appeal, but you know, take some chances as well.
Up-and-coming filmmakers would be nice.
Up-and-coming filmmakers.
Okay, you have $100 million. Yeah. Blumhouse has like a pretty hard and fast rule, like nothing under five. Make 20 films
exactly.
with 20 first-time directors.
Well, you probably need some of that for like marketing and stuff like that, but like at least...
make 10 films.
At that point, at least 10. Like with $100 million, you make 10 movies with... interesting young filmmakers with something to prove.
Yeah.
You develop those projects, you try to make them as exciting as possible, you find the right release date for them. And yeah, if you make them that cheap, they don't have to make a lot of money to make a profit, and you can keep on doing that.
Yeah.
If as long as some of them are profitable, you're good. You can even afford to take a few losses. So I think that's a good business model. I really do. I think, honestly, I think, maybe I would, like, in order to, like, be on the safe side, I would, like, splurge and buy the rights to, like, one of the bigger horror franchises that hasn't been, like, updated in a while, like Pumpkinhead.
Okay.
Like, we're overdue for a new Pumpkinhead, I think. Let's put Pumpkinhead back in theaters. A Pumpkinhead remake or reboot or whatever? Sure. Badass. Pumpkinhead rules, by the way.
Or I'd want to do something really, really arch. Like, take a screenplay that's something really well known.
Yeah.
Screenplay to Star Wars.
Okay.
And...
I'm sure Disney would be happy with this.
Well, okay. Maybe not Star Wars. Maybe something I could, like, afford. Okay. Night of the Living Dead.
Great.
Public domain.
Yeah.
Give that same script to 10 different filmmakers.
Mm-hmm.
And say, go nuts. And release them all in the same year.
Yeah.
Like, just this series of experiments to see how people kind of adapt to that sort of thing.
I think it'd be great. Yeah. I think about this kind of thing a lot, actually.
One of my dream projects, actually, it's not a movie, but it's a TV series, but based on filmmaking. It's sort of like Chopped, you know, where you're given a basket of limited ingredients, you have to make a dish out of those things.
You give filmmakers some obstacles. It's the five obstructions of the series.
Yeah. You hire a filmmaker.
Yeah.
If you can get famous people, great. If not, no worries. But you say you have to make this script. Everybody's handed the same script, but each of them is given a different set of creative obstructions. You have to film it in a certain amount of time, a certain location.
Yeah,
you have to film it in a certain format.
Yeah, it has to be done in French, but no one on the production can speak French.
Yeah, that kind of
stuff. Something, you know.
Yeah, yours is a silent film. Yours is a musical film. But you know, tell this story, but do it like in that way, and then you kind of have a contest at the end. You have like a panel of judges. Mm. That sounds fun to me. Problem is, it'd be really time-consuming.
Anyway, there were rumors that they were going to remake The Five Obstructions with Martin Scorsese, but apparently it was just rumors. It was never really a thing.
Oh, like Lars von Trier was going to challenge Scorsese next?
I don't know if it was Lars von Trier, but like they were going to try like Scorsese, like remake Taxi Driver, but with these rules or whatever like that.
Oh, interesting.
I don't think
Watch The Five Obstructions, by the way. It's an excellent film. Lars von Trier is very fond of a filmmaker called Jürgen Leth, is his name. Mm. And he said, I love you at the short film you did back in the 60s. We're going to remake it, but we're going to have like all these weird rules that I'm laying down for no reason, just to see. And Lars von Trier says, my goal is to make you a bad filmmaker.
Yeah.
I think you're great, but I think I can make you bad somehow.
Yeah. Can an artist who has talent and something to say be stymied by... fate, contrivance, just obstacles in their path, and as long as he can still actually make the movie, he's good.
And Lars von Trier has to confess at the end, is like, well, I was a dick about all of this. It's really great.
Yeah.
Question number three: what music albums do you think could be turned into a movie?
Oh, that's
a good question.
Because
it's been done with The Wall. It's been done with Tommy.
Yeah.
There aren't. Sergeant
Pepper, kind of.
There aren't a lot of concept records these days, so you'd have to sort of reach back a little bit.
I think you can do it as long as you're willing to be abstract.
Maybe
like, I think Paranoid Android could be a good sci-fi movie in a very, Alphaville kind of way.
Ooh, OK Computer would make a good movie.
I mean, that's what I meant. Sorry, Paranoid Android is a song on OK Computer.
Yeah.
That's what I meant. OK Computer.
OK Computer
would be a great sci-fi
Radiohead would be a good
potentially. And that kind of 1970s experimental THX 1138 kind of vibe.
If you wanted to, take a Miles Davis record and actually like try to adapt that somehow in like a Fantasia kind of a way.
Miles Davis actually did some time to either Trouble Man, like you could just redo Trouble Man.
Put
it back into a movie.
You know what? I got got an album kind of recently by Primus, a band I was very fond of in high school. Yeah. And they're still around. They're still touring. And they put out a record called The Desaturating Seven, which was based on the Ulderico children's novel, The Rainbow Goblins. If you remember The Rainbow Goblins, maybe not really, a lot of people know this one. It's about little goblins, each one, you know, there's seven of them, one for each color of the rainbow. And the paintings are really cool looking, these little goblins. They wear these robes. And what they do is they throw lassos up into the air, and they capture rainbows, and they squeeze all the color out, and they eat it. And they rob the sky of color. They're kind of like these villainous characters. And they've heard of the Valley of the Rainbow, and they take this long journey out to the Valley of the Rainbow. The animals and the plants sort of catch wind that the goblins are coming, so they have to sort of come up with a conspiracy as to how to stop the goblins from coming and gobbling up the rainbows. Wonderful paintings, wonderful artwork in that book. Came out in like the early 80s, I think.
Yeah.
Primus made a record about the book.
Wow.
And I would love to see not an adaptation of the book, but a musical of the record that Primus made.
Nice.
And it would make this great sort of... I'm not sure if you're familiar with Primus. They're kind of like...
Oh, I know
Primus. Plinky, bass-forward, very unusual band.
Yeah, if you've, if you've heard their songs, you would, like, recognize them, because they have a very particular tone.
Mm-hmm. A lot of, like, a...
Very bass-forward.
Les Claypool is the bassist. Yeah,
great band.
I'd love to see a movie of the Primus record, The Desaturating Seven.
I would love to see... a movie version of A Flock of Seagulls.
Which, the first record?
The first record, which was a concept album about UFOs.
About space alien abduction.
Like, I ran so far away, that's about running away from aliens.
A Flock of Seagulls is legit, by the
way. Oh, yeah!
They got mocked because of that guy's hairdo, and they're considered like a one-hit wonder.
Yeah, they kind of like had those one or two hits.
A pretty solid
band. They're a good band. Yeah. They're really good band. I feel like the obvious mold for these is a film that they made about, I think it was a play first, and there was music first, then it was a play, then it was a movie called Sunshine on Leith.
Oh, yeah.
Which was a movie that they basically, it's a jukebox musical. They took all the better songs by the Proclaimers, who are best known in America for their song 500 Miles from the Benny and June soundtrack. When I wake up, well, I know I'm going to be one of the catchiest songs ever.
If I wake up.
They have a whole bunch of hit albums, especially in Britain. And I love them so much. They're just one of my favorite bands ever. They're one of my happy bands. And they made a pretty good movie. Not a great movie. It's pretty forced at times. But they made a pretty good movie just sort of taking all of their songs and kind of working around them as kind of a jukebox musical. I think I would like a sort of an experimental Giorgio de Metropolis OK Computer one. And then more of a fanciful sort of pop opera Flock of Seagulls.
Okay.
Movie. I think those would be my two that I would think. Very different films. Sci-fi, but otherwise very different.
Damn. Like, there's some wonderful albums that I think would make, like, some good Fantasia-like project. Like, short films based on each song.
Yeah.
But, hard to think of, like, a movie that would have, like, a story to it.
Not every album has a clear narrative like that. But some albums do are focused on a theme.
Yeah.
And some of the ones that have, like, narratives are either based on something.
What do you think of Across the Universe, the Julie Taymor movie?
I like that movie.
I kind of like it, too.
Yeah, a lot of people... There's two schools of thought on All Across the Universe, which is a jukebox musical Julie Taymor made. Julie Taymor, the director of Titus, and she did The Lion King on Broadway. Incredible filmmaker. She did a musical set to the music of the Beatles, but set in the 1960s where there were no Beatles.
Where the music informs the story and the actions... Mm-hmm. But they were just sort of springing organically from the characters' experiences rather than Beatles songs playing on the... So the characters would sing those songs.
Some people who are Beatles purists, and I consider myself a bit of a Beatles purist, actually. Some people who are Beatles purists sort of scoff at that movie because it takes the Beatles out of the out of the equation. I kind of like it because I think it argues that what the Beatles were capturing was endemic of the era, and what even if the Beatles weren't there, the sentiments would have been would have existed, maybe in a slightly different form. So yeah, it's big and brash and silly sometimes, as a lot of Taymor stuff is, but I like that movie a lot, actually.
Starts with Jim Sturgis turning to the camera and saying, girl.
That's Moulin Rouge. I just did that.
Jason Jones, is there anybody going to listen to my story all about the girl who came to stay? And he tells the story of the girl who came to stay.
I see what you did there. Yeah, some of the songs are more forced than others, but it's good. I like that movie.
And somehow they worked in Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite, which makes no fucking sense.
Well, they decided to make an acid trip. It's set in the 60s. There was this TV miniseries in like the early 2000s or late 90s that was called The 60s.
And then they did the 70s and the 80s as well.
Right. The 60s was a huge hit. And it was basically, we're going to tell a story about a family, a big sprawling family. And by sheer coincidence, every interesting thing that happened in the 60s, this family was involved, was there.
Yeah.
One of them was in the army. One of them was a hippie. One of them was all... And... It is mawkish and maudlin and contrived. And if it had had Beatles music, it would have been the exact same movies across the universe, I swear to God. It's basically the same thing.
Wow.
It's pretty amazing.
Right.
Anyway.
Question four.
Okay. We're still going.
What movies would you love to see adapted into a musical? Examples of movies turned into musicals: Waitress, Legally Blonde, The Bodyguard, Mean Girls, Shrek, American Psycho, my favorite.
I haven't seen most of those, actually. I'm sure most of them,
I've seen
are good.
The Spider-Man musical. I was one of the people who got to see that on Broadway.
You're so lucky.
Turn Off the Dark.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. What have I seen recently that would have made a good musical? Something kind of light and fun.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. Because you want something
You know what I want to see as a musical? Mm. I want to see Malignant. I want to see Malignant the musical. I want Gabriel to have a number.
Yes. Agreed.
I want Gabriel to sing Fuck the Police while trashing the police station. That'd be awesome.
That's not bad.
I would watch the hell out of Malignant the musical.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. Because I want it to be something that, like, oh, you know what would be a good musical? Babylon.
Oh, yeah,
Babylon should have been a musical.
I mean, it is, kind of.
But it's not. It should have been a musical. It should have been a proper musical. I think I would have liked Babylon more. Oh, wait, that's Singing in the Rain. Never mind. Gotcha.
it's Singing in the Rain, but, you know, like, bordering on X-rated, you know?
I just had this image in my head of a musical version of The Fablemans, and it's the funniest thing.
Oh my god!
Oh my god!
Somebody definitely would try that. The Fablemans,
sure.
The musical.
That's only a matter of time. I would love it if they did something like, oh, you know, it'd be an amazing. You do a movie musical based on a movie that wasn't a hit, and it's hilarious that you would turn it into a musical. Like, it's practically like a Simpsons sketch.
A Hard Ticket to Hawaii, the musical.
Moonfall,
the musical. Would be
Roland Emmerich's Moonfall.
Amazing.
Yeah, yeah. That would be the best thing in the world, I think.
In fact, you'd call it Moonfall just with an exclamation point.
Like, Moonfall! Love it. It ends with this heroic number. You're part of the moon.
You could work in like an old class. You could sing Blue Moon.
Yeah.
In Moonfall, the musical. Like, license that one.
Oh, yeah.
Have,
well,
like,
there's so many moon songs.
There,
just look at the soundtrack to An American Werewolf in London. They're, like, all moon-related songs.
Yeah,
just do that, basically.
Bad Moon Rising.
Something. Oh, there you go.
And question five.
Yes.
Do you boycott or have great difficulty watching movies with unsavory specific Hollywood creatives? My husband and I recently had a discussion about Woody Allen after I mentioned that I actively avoided his movies after learning about the allegations against him. Before learning about the allegations, I had binged a handful of his movies, but have since decided not to watch any of the others because I have a difficult time separating the art from the artist. Given the nature of the plot of several of his movies, Manhattan, I haven't been able to bring myself to watch any of his other movies. Thank you so much for reviewing and answering my questions. Alex, P.S., as a member of the Call to Action podcast from forever ago, I would like to thank you both for being two of my favorite parts of the SD community, the Schmodown community. As a whole, I loved having you both participate in my Schmobait show when it was hopping, and you're always generous and a hoot of a good time on and off the screen. Thank you for loving Hellbound Hellraiser 2 as much as me. separating the art from the artist, that's, I mean, I, that's going to be a matter of your own personal ethic, whether you can stomach that sort of thing.
My philosophy is that technically you can separate art from the artist, if only through ignorance, just by not knowing who the artist is. But you don't have to. You can choose. You can also choose to watch movies with an asterisk. Like, I want to watch this movie, or I have to watch this movie, but I know this person was a shit, or I don't approve of something about it. And that's just... it's just a big old elephant in the room.
You can put an asterisk next to something and maybe not enjoy it in the way you used to, but
you can't turn that off now.
You can appreciate it while also acknowledging that the person who made it is horrible. The Ren and Stimpy show was very important to me as an adolescent.
Yeah.
That kind of timing and that kind of sense of humor really informed me as an adolescent.
It informs a lot of shows today. It's hard for me to sometimes watch a show, do a Ren and Stimpy riff without realizing you're riffing on.
The Ren and Stimpy show, kind of brought the idea of a creator-based cartoon show into mainstream acceptance, and John Kay sort of spearheaded that. And then you learn that John Kay was being very unsavory with teenage girls.
Like, really grotesque stuff, actually.
And, you know, he's persona non grata now. He's not allowed to make anything. And,
that's right. And the thing is that it's there are variations in this as well, because there are certain people who they were creeps, or they were monsters, they were criminals, but they're dead.
Mm.
And you're not necessarily helping their career, nor does
funding their defense fund.
Yeah. Well, and nor are you contributing to their perceived success, so that you are placing other people in a position to have to work with them, and they might not be safe or comfortable, and so supporting their career isn't necessarily great. We sometimes have to watch movies that have people in them who are gross or have done gross things. There are people who I avoid just because, they made a movie and maybe I'll see it at some point, but I'm very distracted.
Yeah.
That's it. That's what it boils down to, is I can't watch the movie without thinking of the gross stuff, and that's not helping the movie any.
Yeah.
It's just very, very difficult.
It's especially difficult with someone like Woody Allen, who puts so much of himself into those movies.
Oh,
so much of who he is and his strange proclivities kind of reflect on allegations in real life. So it's really difficult with somebody like Woody Allen.
He's a filmmaker who had talent.
Yeah.
As well. And a lot of his movies were significant or influential in some way. We're doing our show Only the Best, and it's eventually we're gonna have to get to Annie Hall.
We're gonna
get Crimes and Misdemeanors was nominated as well.
Bullets Over Broadway, Hannah and Her Sisters. Zelig was up for Best Picture.
Zelig was. Right. I think it was nominated for some Oscars. I don't think it was Best Picture.
But eventually we're gonna have to deal with
that. I'm not looking forward to it, but
And same with Roman Polanski.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Roman, and these are sort of like influential voices in terms of the way cinema moved. Harvey fucking Weinstein, for God's sake.
Kind of
exploded a lot of the indie movie scene in the 1990s. Yeah. Considered a very important figure.
A lot of the most prominent movies of the turn of the century have the indelible stamp of Harvey Weinstein on them. Yeah, and that's not great.
It's seeing his name in front of these movies is now going to sting a little bit.
Yeah.
And the problem is, Harvey Weinstein wasn't the only person who worked on that movie.
True, very true.
There are actually a lot of probably hardworking people who are maybe ignorant of what Harvey Weinstein was up to, who made it and made an important work of art, and I think you can...
Or they might have just been forced to, because that's the only way to work in that industry.
Yeah.
And I have some sympathy for that, you know?
So like they're just working.
Not everyone has enough power to say no to a project.
When it comes to something like that, I think it's perfectly all right to watch something that Harvey Weinstein produced because a lot of other talented artists put on it. I've heard it spun this way before. If you go to any movie, even ones that are made by people who you know to be perfectly decent, you go through the credits, you're going to find some assholes.
Almost guarantee you some of the people in those credits will have been real shits at some point.
Yeah.
But that's my point. You can separate art from the artist constantly because you don't know the backstory of every single person who worked on it.
Another thing I find curious is...
But once you know, you know.
Yeah, once you know, you know. And it's easy for us to wrap our heads around a monstrous person who committed a horrible act. I can still watch L.A. Confidential. because Kevin Spacey mm-hmm. is a small part of that movie. He's only one.
So I feel about Seven as well. Like he's not ubiquitous in the film, mm-hmm. you know. But when he's on screen, I'm like, oh, it's distracting.
Yeah, it's a little distracting. I found it curious, though, that people are able to do that with monstrous people. Like, separate the art from the artist. I don't want to watch a film by Roman Polanski. That's your prerogative. Don't. Mm-hmm. But what about something like a corporate entity that does unethical things?
Yeah.
Look up the legal push and pull between Warner Brothers and the country of New Zealand when it came to the making of the Hobbit movies.
Yeah.
They pressured local politicians to change labor laws so they didn't have to hire local talent and could, like, import people and pay them less.
Yeah.
That's unethical as fuck.
It is. It is. And
but you don't hear about people boycotting Warner Brothers over stuff like that.
And that's tricky because, like, we talk about a lot about how various studios, like Disney, for example, which I support Disney in their fight against Ron DeSantis. I'm also very opposed to Disney for a lot of the other shit that they do.
the hundreds of other unethical things.
When you're that gigantic, there's a lot of different things that you're connected to. Mm-hmm. You might simply be the financier of a movie and not actually have that much to do with it. A lot of the things that Disney creates or the people who work at Disney creates are good or interesting or fun, at least, and they're connected to Disney, but are they Disney, like, as a whole? Like, is it really fair to add the taint of Disney's, you know, problematic corporate practices to my view of the film? I think what it boils down to is these are decisions that I think there's some that are clearer than others.
Yeah.
In terms of there are people who maybe we shouldn't go out of the way to support their career right now. But it's a big enough issue and a complicated enough issue that I don't think that there's one catch-all way to go about it. There's a lot of different respectable ways. I think the only way for me that I think is probably the wrong way to go, and people might disagree with me on this, is to ignore the reality once you know it. If you don't know it, you don't know it. But once you know it, to ignore it, or to actively say to yourself, or even subconsciously say to yourself, I care about enjoying this movie less than I care about the real-life tragedies surrounding it.
Yeah.
That, for me, is the wrong way to go.
Hmm.
It doesn't mean you can't watch the movie, but I do believe, I think what we say is we put an asterisk next to it. It's this movie, but there's also this other thing, and we can't pretend that that's not there, you know?
A friend of mine put it this way. A friend of mine is a big metalhead. Likes, you know, metal, listen to death metal, like the really dark shit.
Sure.
And he says that, you know, when a lot of allegations start to come to light about stars in Hollywood and producers and actors and comedians and what have you, and they just proved to be, like, criminals and sex pests. He said he was used to that because he was already a metalhead.
Yeah.
He was used to hearing that his heroes were just horrible people.
Yeah.
And there, I spent my 20s trying to, like, push limits. I saw some pretty extreme shit in my day. I was trying to provoke myself, you know, trying to see where my limits were.
Yeah.
It kind of gave me a bit of a thick skin, you know, when I'm watching documentary films with, like, actual animal death, that kind of stuff. I was in my 20s. I was, you know, trying to get into the sick shit. If you have that sort of a thick skin, there's going to be a point where you can watch anything. And you're going to be okay with it. Because you're watching a movie and you understand that horrible people made it. And you're not okay with the crimes they committed, but you're okay with the fact that horrible people sometimes make art. Whether or not you can roll with that darkness is going to depend on your character.
There's a good line, and I don't think it's always used in this context, but there's a good line Roger Ebert had where he said that movies are machines that create empathy.
Yeah.
I'm paraphrasing that. But that's what they do. They create the ability to empathize with other people, and other characters, and other situations. If you are watching movies because you care, because you're connecting with artists or the characters that they're telling stories about, if you're using the art to expand your ability to care and value things, it's probably going to be hard for you to completely separate those things. Yeah. Because you're being taught to care about things. And then there are some people who want to say, but you shouldn't care about this real thing because this is just a movie.
Yeah.
Oh. And that makes it complicated.
Yeah.
It really does. I sympathize with that. Again, I think the only bad thing we can do is pretend it doesn't matter. You can absolutely watch things, but I just think to pretend it didn't happen or doesn't exist, that's not the healthy thing to do. It's basically just to say, we can't unknow what we know. We try to not support actively people who, if they were welcomed back into the industry, would be doing harm or bringing people into situations that they would be uncomfortable in or unhealthy. And beyond that, we do our best. So, yeah, as critics, you know, there are certain people who are just absolutely persona non grata, but there's still also movies that you and I just have to watch.
Yeah.
Because that's the gig, and it's not always the fun part.
And if I were assigned a film that was made by a monster, I would do my due diligence.
Yeah.
I'd watch it and see, you know, but I would be careful in my review to bring up the context.
Yeah.
I wouldn't review it without context.
Yeah, you don't
not my job.
Yeah.
Plus, that's not the way I write. I have to contextualize everything.
Yeah.
It's gotten me in trouble with editors before because I over-contextualize things sometimes.
It's clarity.
Yeah.
I think it's important. I really do.
Mm.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, could you get to the review faster? No, I need three paragraphs of context before I even get to the movie.
Just sprinkle in the occasional, the movie's fine, but first let me talk about this.
Yeah, I had to start training myself to like say something about the movie up front and then put my three paragraphs
of
context.
That's the trick. I did that too. I did that with my... I do almost everything I do.
Yeah.
My intros to my reviews tend to be like, why are you starting here? Okay, two paragraphs, this will make sense, I promise. It happens a lot.
Just follow me closely.
Anyway.
Another letter?
I think I have time for one more, because we said we started with a digression. We'll do one extra letter.
All right, so here's a letter from Dr. Nova.
Hi, Dr. Nova. Good to hear from you again.
Hi, Bibbs and Whitney. I am out of the movie sphere. I think completely out, and it's weird.
Yeah.
Movies during high school and when I was depressed were a major thing to me. Not only watching movies, but talking about them. But now I've changed a lot, and since 2021, I've watched far less movies and gained more hands and hobbies, which has led to mainly listening to podcasts while I do other stuff.
Okay.
Hands-on hobbies.
Ah, okay.
You haven't gained more hands. That's a little weird. Plus, on top of that, my engagement with movie channels on YouTube is non-existent. And I blinked and all the channels I used to watch are gone. I think the only one I watch now is Dan Merle once a week.
Dan Merle's great.
We know Dan Merle.
Yeah, Dan Merle's wonderful.
It's so weird because movies were a core interest of mine for like 25 years and now it's just gone. I don't know if it will come back and even if it does, to what capacity, because I still watch movies sometimes, but I don't engage with them like I used to. Looking at my Letterboxd first-time watches, not so many repeats or old favorites. I watched 98 movies in 2021, fueled mainly by excitement in lockdown, and losing weight and being low energy from all the training I was doing.
Okay.
Then you get to 2022, and that was 26 movies. For the first time that year, I had a lot more things going on, and I had a tight schedule, and I didn't watch any more movies for like 8 months. 2023, 5 months, I've watched 14 new movies. The amount is up now, but I engage with but how I engage with them is very different now because I'm not talking about them with people anymore, not like I used to.
Okay.
All my hobbies involve me talking to people about them, so without someone to talk to about movies, there really isn't much I can do except watch the movie, which is only part of how I do everything else, but is also how I enjoy video games.
It's okay.
A weird shift.
Yeah.
Signed, Dr. Nova. P.S. Get off of Twitter and join Discord instead.
I can't do Discord.
I've been looking for a good Twitter alternative. I tried Hey.Cafe, but they don't have an online app.
Yeah, it's really I really like that one.
It's really quiet. Hey.Cafe is so relaxing.
I've made a lot of accounts in a lot of different places, but thus far, nothing I've felt the need to really... Mm-hmm. Basically, I'm there if everyone moves over there.
Yeah. Where it starts to shift, that's where I will go.
Yeah. But it sounds like what you're talking about...
Twitter's turning into... Well, I mean, it's always been a sewer, but now it's just a worse sewer.
Well, it sounds like what you're talking about, Dr. Nova, is... By the way, to change your interests over time is 100% normal and totally cool. Mm-hmm. And we've had people write into us before. It's like, hey, I don't know, I'm not feeling movies. And it's like... Don't change hobbies. Do it. You don't have to. I know it sounds like we're just saying, like, you know, we're kind of putting down our own agenda here, but like, it's like we're a movie podcast. We'd very much like you to listen, but
Well, look, if we want you to enjoy movies.
Yeah, if you're not enjoying them, what's the point?
Yeah, if you're not into the medium, we're not going to force you. That's something we learned a long time ago. You know, when you're young, you're a teenager,
20s. You have strong opinions.
You have strong opinions, and your tendency is to shame people who aren't in on the know.
Yeah. Like,
you haven't seen a Clockwork Orange. How dare you? You're not a real movie fan.
And shut up, 17-year-old me.
Well, when it's a bunch of 17-year-olds in a room and you're shaming each other, that's just good fun. When you move online and turn into an asshole about it, that's the issue.
I think it can be gatekeepy and annoying either way, but it's more understandable.
I feel like gatekeeping is like a phase through which everyone must pass. It's something you have to
grow. As long as you pass, that's the trick. You got to pass out of that shit. But what you're talking about is, and this is the thing that I think is interesting, is the idea of movies as a social thing. Because movies can be private.
Mm.
You don't have to discuss them with anybody. You can just watch them, feel the experience all to yourself, enjoy it, have it wash over you, contemplate it, and then go about your day. You don't have to make a social experience. But so much of a movie is a social experience. This is one of the things that people really felt the lack of during lockdown, was not being able to see movies in a big crowd. Mm. When people said the movies are back, the movies never went anywhere. I'm not a huge fan of that phrase. But the movie-going experience, as you cared about it, as a social experience, even with a group full of strangers, that was gone.
Mm.
And a lot of people love that. And I think that's one of the things that we care so much about movies about, is the idea that we're all looking at the same thing and having our own reaction to it. And those reactions feed off of each other and fuel each other. Sometimes it turns into groupthink, but, you know, that's just, we all saw the same thing and had, you know, our energy accumulates. If that's what's important to you and you're not getting that because the YouTube channels that gave you that are gone now, or you just don't have anyone you're watching movies with right now, yeah, do other stuff. There's so many other things. There's so many other things we could be doing. There really are. There just aren't that many other things I'm interested in. And that's what it boils down to for me. If there ever comes a day when I... And there have been days when I've been like, ugh, movies again. But it's usually very fleeting.
Yeah.
And I always come back.
Well, and
if I ever stop caring, I'll do something else with my time.
I adore the cinema. It's part of my subconscious. At the same time, I also hate movies from time to time. There's this speech where Keanu Reeves is talking about cinema. And he just sort of steps up to a microphone in front of a crowd. I don't even remember what the event was. And he just says, I love movies.
Yeah.
I love movies. I just want to say, have you seen movies? There's some shit out there.
Yeah.
I love movies. Here's Most Extreme Primate. Do you love movies now?
Hey, he made some shit like that early on in his career.
He has. Do you love the shit you made? That's just me being strident. But
just because you love something doesn't mean you can't also have other feelings for it as well.
I also think you love
something, but you don't have to love every single aspect of it. You know?
We love it, and we've seen so many movies that we like them to be not merely entertaining, we want them to be great.
Our standards have been raised.
Yeah, so it's, you know, and that's why a lot of people say that, you know, critics are so pewy. They don't really like movies. No, we like movies. We just like really good ones.
Yeah.
So we're going to dismiss the ones that you find just mildly distracting.
A critic who's doing the job, like a full-time job of being a critic, probably sees many times more movies than the average person complaining about critics. Yeah. And as a result, their perspective is a little different than yours.
Yeah.
You know?
Now, if you're losing interest in cinema in general, and your interests are skewing in another direction, there's nothing wrong with putting movies
down. And I don't think Dr. Nova is saying that, but I'm talking about, because I know we've had other people bring this up to us
now,
in the past.
Now, if you've noticed that your interest in films is waning and that distresses you, and you actually are interested in picking up the interest again, that's a separate issue. And I'll first
Dr. Nova is talking about, but we're having conversation.
But that's a specific thing, and I've heard people saying, "I'm losing interest. How do I get interest again?"
Yeah.
Roger Ebert had a specific solution. He said, "Go back to the start.
Mm.
Go back to the earliest films you can find. Mm. Watch a lot of like early experimental shorts when people were just experimenting with cameras back in like the year 1900.
They're talking about the start of the cinematic craft.
Watch a lot of old, really, really old movies, old silent movies. Not
get out of whatever wave you're aware of.
1920. Just watch movies from there.
Before the rules had been invented.
Yeah, you'll find that there's a lot of excitement happening because people are excited about just the tools.
Yeah.
I've found that a great way to sort of rekindle interest is to move as far as possible out of your comfort zone.
Mm. Watch a movie from a country you've never yeah, seen exactly. a movie from before.
If you've never seen a movie from a certain country or even a certain continent,
yeah.
go there. See what it yeah. is. Do some like cultural research.
Mm-hmm. Watch a movie in a genre you've never enjoyed.
Yeah.
Like, if everyone says it's great, try to figure out why.
Documentaries are a great place to go.
Sure.
It's like, these are cinema, but at the same time, they're kind of informative. Mm-hmm. So, they're stimulating your mind in a different kind of way from a scripted drama.
Read.
Read a lot.
Read a lot. But also, like, read about movies. Sometimes mm-hmm. we get so focused on the research of movies or, like, the study of movies that involves just watching, watching the movies that we forget that they're actually really great books that can amplify that. I recently picked up a book and it's been really inspirational, actually, just how incredibly well written it is. It's a collection of critiques. It's called It Came from the Closet, Queer Reflections on Horror.
I've seen that on bookshelves.
Pick it up. It's great.
Hmm.
I haven't read every single piece of it, but I've read a lot of it, and it's all very insightful, very personal stories from queer critics of all walks of life talking about how various horror movies were important to them and mm-hmm. Their readings, and particularly their queer readings of movies, including movies that I think the reason why I picked up the book, other than just I heard it was good, but when I looked it over and I saw like the table of contents, like here are the movies that are being written about. There was one that was like the queer reading of Jaws, and I was like, really, Jaws?
Yes, you have my interest.
Yeah, you have my interest. What is the queer reading of Jaws?
What's the Django Unchained?
Oh, you have my interest, now you have my attention.
You had my interest, now you have my attention, yeah.
Which I always feel like is a little backwards. Like, you have my attention, but now you have my interest. Like, I don't know. But that was a great, I don't want to ruin it for you, that was a great essay, and it really opened my eyes to a lot of things and a lot of the ways that other people view cinema. And it made me think about the way that I view cinema in a way that I hadn't really before. Again, I only discovered who I am and fully acknowledged my own queerness very recently. I went through like about 4 decades not really understanding it. And now I look back at, thanks to this book, I'm looking back at some of the horror movies I saw early on that I connected to, and realizing that some of the things I connected to,
like,
we're speaking to me subconsciously in ways that I really wasn't thinking about. And now I look back at like how I view Nightbreed and I'm like, oh god, that movie is so ace. Okay, great. Okay, cool. All right. So now I'm like, it's exciting to me.
Yeah.
So like, it's just to get this lens. So, and to see the other people's lenses through it. So I recommend that book, by the way, if anyone wants to read a good book about just horror and film criticism and queerness.
I've hyped it on the show before, but I'm very fond of A.O. Scott's book.
Yeah.
It's called Better Living Through Criticism. Yeah. And it's just this series of essays he wrote about the art of criticism. A.O. Scott, by the way, left film criticism.
Anyway,
he was just sick of it. He even wrote in sort of his final piece that he loves movies, but he also kind of hates them. He sort of resents the power cinema has over him. And he wrote this really good book about sort of the nature of criticism, and it sort of explores how criticism is a very unusual art. It's an art form unto itself.
Yeah.
Its medium is other art, and that's kind of the way it's unusual.
All art is a reaction to something, but film criticism is a reaction to very specific works of art.
Yeah. And if you look at art in a certain way, all art builds off of previous art, doesn't it?
You know, and life itself. Yeah, like, Harold, you have something in your life you're unhappy with.
Harold Bloom talked a lot about the anxiety of influence. Harold Bloom, another problematic figure, I understand. But,
sure.
He talked about how, can you take influence without making it seem like you took influence? Because, the pressure of the artist is to be original. So every work of art is, in a way, a criticism of other art that came before. Mm-hmm. Either you're approving of previous art and imitating it, mm-hmm. or you're rejecting other art and doing something the opposite.
Yeah, exactly.
And so criticism is just a little bit more explicit about it. It's sort of this mm-hmm. blend of an artistic reaction and an analytical paper, making it this really kind of all brain. He's very highfalutin about
criticism.
But
that's criticism. That's how I approach it, too. Yeah. I think that's so, how I think when I think about criticism. Yeah.
And of course, A.O. Scott is incredibly well-read. He's incredibly cultured. He knows a lot about just the history of art. So it's also tickles the intellectual part of my brain as well. I really highly recommend that book. And it'll get you thinking about films sort of in a conscious way.
Yeah.
In a way that you may not be considering them otherwise. Yeah. And I think if you start to watch films,
kind of what I'm talking
you
about.
Can actually watch films in a little bit more of an intellectual capacity mm-hmm. and find a new kind of thrill.
That's what I'm talking about. Yeah. When you find books, and I encourage you to read books about everything, because it'll enrich your life, but even it will also enrich your cinematic life too, because mm-hmm. books don't exist in movies don't exist in a vacuum. They exist in a world with life and other works of art. But to really immerse yourself in other people's point of view. And I realize that's probably why you're listening to podcasts, because that's part of it. But don't forget to read a book, because sometimes those things are far more focused. People can choose their words more carefully and really get into some really interesting, really, really, what's the word I'm looking for here? Important. I think places, and it can be really eye opening. So that might be a cool thing to do. But in any case, Dr. Nova, we hope you keep listening. But regardless, good for you. I hope things are going really, really well in your journey, and all those new hobbies that you got and everything are going really well for you. I hope you're really, really happy, and I hope that for every single person listening to this show. Thank you for joining us. Thank you to everybody who wrote in. If we didn't get your email, we apologize. We might read it next time. You can always try again. If there's ever anything super important, you can always poke Whitney. You can write in. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Whitney, what is our P.O. Box?
Send us an actual physical letter to P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yeah. We're on Twitter @criticacclaim. I'm @WilliamBibiani.
I'm @WhitneySeibel.
The Patreon. So patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. Hug your loved ones.
Mm.
Pet a cat.
If you have a kitten,
tell
the kitten it's the best kitten in the world and give it a snuggle for me.
Next time you're at the market, get your favorite snack. Treat yourself. The good kind, not the store brand. Unless that's your brand.
365 brand at Whole Foods. Legit.
Yeah, it's fine.
And affordable.
Yeah. Anyway, sincerely, Bibbs and Whitney. Bye.